Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. There are jobs you hate and jobs you love, and this woman has one of the latter.
Here I am getting paid to do this kind of stuff.
That's Susie Hollyhead with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Susie's got a job that's the envy of her friends, and she's pretty happy with it too. Just listen.
Here I am getting paid to do this kind of stuff.
So here's a quiz. What job does Susie feel lucky to have? Is she A, a fashion trend spotter? Dolce & Gabbana send her around the world to see what the beautiful people are wearing. Or does Susie B, work for a green consulting firm? She shows businesses simple ways to save the planet, and she's well rewarded for it. Or is this wonder job C, professional mattress testing? Yes, Susie gets paid to sleep. No clue? Wake up! The answer is coming up on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
A green employee is usually the guy who just got hired and can't even find the restroom yet. But there's another kind of green employee in high demand, the kind of worker that could help a company go green. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
The latest employment figures show the economy added about 180,000 new jobs in March. That's about what economists were expecting, and another sign that the job market remains strong despite weakness in other parts of the economy. Most of the new jobs were in construction or healthcare, but there's another part of the economy that is hot, 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 the green sector, as in jobs that help the environment. We asked Sam Eaton from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk to look into just what it takes to go green collar.
Susie Hollyhead calls herself the urinal queen for a reason.
We have an 8-second flush, and I see no indication that it's an ultra-low-flow toilet, so there could be some savings there.
Hollyhead directs the business greening program for a Los Angeles nonprofit group, Sustainable Works. Today, she's doing an environmental assessment for a large construction firm. Hollyhead writes up a laundry list of changes the business can make in order to be more environmentally conscious. Things like installing low-flow toilets and switching to 100% recycled printing paper.
Just simple things like that really make a difference and pretty easy to implement. And so here I am getting paid to do this kind of stuff.
Hollyhead says her salary is great for a nonprofit, but her quality of life is even better. She rides her bike between jobs and lives near the beach in Santa Monica, California. These so-called green-collar jobs are growing faster than almost any other career path. Take environmental consulting and engineering. Kevin Doyle with the Environmental Careers Organization in Boston says jobs in that sector are expected to grow 5.5% a year through the end of the decade. And with companies fighting over talent, wages are also rising.
I am more optimistic now that not only are there a lot of jobs for people who want to do this kind of work, but that the outcomes of those jobs will actually produce the kind of results that environmentalists have been thinking about for a long time.
In other words, real changes in things like environmental efficiency and resource use. Doyle says those considering a move into one of these careers should pick a specific path.
So if climate change turns you on, go with that. You might pick air quality or water quality. Find an issue, get the skills you need, be passionate, and you'll be fine.
Boning up on green job skills is easier than ever, with more colleges offering environmental studies programs and green MBAs. But applying those skills isn't always easy. Auden Schindler heads Aspen Skiing Company's Environmental Affairs Department.
The problem is you come out often from these programs very idealistic, and you get into the real world, and it's like coming over the top of a trench and getting machine gunned.
Schindler has one of the most coveted green jobs in the country. He gets dozens of resumes a week from college students hoping he's hiring. But Schindler says jobs like his often have more to do with luck than anything else. And for that reason, his advice is to reinvent the job you're already doing rather than seeking out a new one.
Every job is a sustainability job. If you're working for ExxonMobil, we need you in there as an environmentalist and an advocate of sustainability. So my advice has always been turn your job into a green job.
Schindler says many of today's corporate sustainability departments were formed after employees took the lead. And it doesn't stop at the cubicle. Aretha Inslee is behind a budding movement by the Los Angeles Apollo Alliance to help low-income communities like South LA get a slice of the green economy.
We're talking about everyday jobs, carpentry. We're talking about learning how to put windows in or weatherization. We don't need college educators to do that. We do need the blue collar. We need trained people.
Inslee says with city-funded green apprenticeship programs, low-skilled workers would be able to boost their earning power overnight. She says not only would that fill the need for more boots on the ground, it would bring life back to poor and minority neighborhoods that once served as the blue-collar base for cities like Los Angeles. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
I don't know about you, but I hated the early 70s. At least I'm sure I would have if I'd been old enough to remember them. Long lines at gas stations, hot pants. And then there was that one word on every financial expert's tongue, stagflation. It's the combo of high inflation combined with a shrinking economy, and it's coming back in style. Zanny Mitten-Beddoes is with The Economist magazine. Zanny, I've seen peasant shirts back on the runway. What are we seeing in the economy?
We're not looking at a return to the 1970s. The term stagflation originated, as you know, from the 70s, and it's now, you know, synonymous with bell bottoms and all the other terrible things from that period. But what economists are noticing is that the economy is pretty sluggish, and yet inflation is pretty stubborn. And up until recently, you could find people who worried about inflation, and you could find people who worried about growth. But you tended not to find people who worried about both of them. But now it seems that we really do face the prospect of an economy that's weak, but one where inflation is stubbornly above the rate that the central bankers are comfortable with.
What happens to consumers in a time of stagflation? What is the biggest risk for the average Joe?
Well, let's not call it stagflation. One Wall Street economist has talked about slowflation.
Okay.
And I think that's actually probably a more accurate statement. What we're talking about is sluggish, slow growth and stubborn inflation. If inflation is more stubborn than people thought, then you should not expect interest rates to fall as quickly as they would otherwise have done. And if growth is sluggish, well, that bodes badly for equities and so forth. The conclusion is that you should be more defensive than you would have been in the absence of this.
How much worse could it potentially get if it gets really bad?
Well, both growth and inflation could worsen substantially. So on the growth side, we could have an economy that falls into recession. Mm-hmm. And on the inflation side, you could have inflation rising higher than its current kind of 2.5%. I think the best indicator of whether inflation is getting out of control is to look at inflation expectations. There are consumer surveys that look at that. There's the spread of the inflation-protected TIPS market, the Treasury market. And if you look at that and you see that inflation expectations are rising sharply, then I would really start getting worried. On the growth side, well, you know, it's hard to predict just how weak the economy could become. But I would say that, you know, the mortgage question is really the biggest one. And, you know, so far we've had a huge collapse in construction and we've now got people nervous because of what's going on in the subprime market. If that expands further, then I would really start worrying about the underlying health of the economy.
Is there any way that we can avoid that situation?
Yeah, the most likely scenario, I think, is still that we have quite a protracted period of sluggish growth like we've had right now, but that eventually the fundamentals of the underlying economy, the rest of the economy is still quite strong, that productivity growth is still stronger than it was in those stagflationary days of the 1970s, and that the basic dynamic of the economy is still okay. The risk is obviously that things get very weak quite quickly, or on the other side, that inflation starts accelerating and then that the Fed really has to slam on the brakes, which is kind of traditional recipe for a recession.
All right. Zanny Mittenbettos is the U.S. economics editor for The Economist. Thanks so much for coming in and helping us sort this through.
My pleasure.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Right now, all over the country, high school seniors are deciding which colleges to say yes to. And part of that decision, no doubt, rests on how much financial aid they'll be getting. Unfortunately, the financial aid system has a black eye right now. The New York Attorney General is investigating kickbacks and other unseemly schemes among financial aid officers and student loan lenders. But scandal aside, students still need money. And we wondered how students might get more than what their school of choice is offering. Can you, should you, try to haggle? Cindy Bailey is with the College Board. And Cindy, under what circumstances might a college amend that initial offer?
They would want to know two things. One, if there's something new that's happened in the family since the family reported their situation to the financial aid office. Mm-hmm. You know, has there been somebody who's lost their job? Has there been illness in the family? Has there been some catastrophic expense that wasn't anticipated? The second thing would be if, despite the best efforts of the financial aid office, the family still thinks they can't afford it. If they could just give me a little more here or tweak this there, that would make all the difference.
If you are going back to a school and asking for a better offer of financial aid, what could you potentially expect in return? Would you be looking at, you know, a different amount or a different interest rate, or kind of what would the options be?
It could be many things. It could be a different amount in terms of a loan amount. Most of the loans are quite similar in terms of their interest rate. So it's not like they'd come back to you and say, you know, we'll cut your interest rate. That's pretty unlikely. Mm-hmm. It's more a situation of trying to see, is there some money out there that either you haven't accessed or where they might have additional funds where they can help you?
But in terms of what the college or university is going to offer you, you're not going to go from, you know, an offer of $10,000 to $30,000.
That would be very unlikely.
Yeah.
Unless the family situation has so radically changed.
Yeah.
But could you go from 10 to 12, 10 to 11, if that's all that would make the difference between going to the school or not? Financially, people are also very bound by federal regulations and often state regulations. So sometimes they don't have a whole lot of choice either. If your, quote, calculated need has been met, it's just that they're not free to sort of, because you make a good case emotionally, just dip into the well more if they're using federal money.
Is it ever a good idea to try to play schools off one another? I mean, if you think you're a really great candidate and you've got all these schools, you know, wanting to admit you, go to one office and say, look, I'm getting a better deal from the other one. What can you give me?
I would not recommend that, although I know it's probably done. The issue is not trying to figure out where you're going to get the best deal. It still is an issue of where's the best match.
Right.
You might be able to get a really good deal at some school and be miserable there. And that's when really good deal doesn't mean a whole lot. I think it's more important that students very carefully and thoughtfully figure out what's the best environment for them, what's the best academic program, what school offers that, where do they feel the most comfortable, and then the financing will follow.
Cindy Bailey is Executive Director of Education Finance Service at the College Board. Thanks so much for the advice.
Thanks, Jess.
You've put too much on your credit cards. Should you consolidate? Chris mulls it over in the mailbag. And you think communication's difficult in your office?
Just imagine almost every single document that comes out will come out in 6 languages.
A day in the work life of a translator. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tessa Veglund. This week, Iran announced it's started producing nuclear fuel on an industrial scale. The UN says Iran is overstating its fuel-making abilities. Still, the situation is delicate, so it's of utmost importance that everyone involved understand each other. literally. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we speak in tongues with a United Nations document translator.
My name is Sadoun Swaya, a United Nations employee at the Arabic Translation Service in the United Nations headquarters, New York. This was a translation from a document about a United Nations operation. This has to be translated into six languages.
Official languages of the UN. These are Arabic, English, French, Russian, Chinese, and Spanish. And just imagine, almost every single document that comes out will come out in six languages. That's why I think there will always be demand on translators. The translators come from all over the Arab world. You have people from Morocco, from Tunisia, from Algeria, from Libya, from Egypt, from Lebanon, from Syria. You really have to go through a very rigorous competitive examination. After that, you have to go through a series of interviews. We are supposed to be la crème de la crème. We should set the standards, you know, of acceptable and good Arabic. As a translator, your role really is to be as accurate as possible in conveying the message. You are not responsible for the content. We all have our own feelings about conditions in the world. But as a translator, you are expected to do your work impartially, confidentially, and accurately to the best of your abilities. If someone said, I'm dying to be a translator, I would say, go for it. But I just have to ask, actually, a question. Do you seriously see yourself as a translator, or is it just because you look at the glamorous side of the UN, you know, that big place with lots of heads of state and ministers and things? It's an institution where a lot of nitty-gritty kind of work takes place. Sometimes, day after day, you're doing these documents. Not all of them are interesting. Some of them are well-written, some of them are badly written. There is a lot of drudgery, but it has its rewards. Personally now, I get less than $7,000 per month, so you can work it out. What, $83,000, I think? It hasn't made me really rich yet, but I think still it puts you into that comfortable bracket of the population. Some of the computer terminology, the word virtual in English now, a virtual program, a virtual university, there is just no one word in Arabic that takes this. We have to use a phrase or explain it. Now, system in Arabic is Nivam. So the PowerPoint system, I would say, Wa Nivam PowerPoint. You see? So we get around it this way. In the final analysis, human languages are intertranslatable. It's difficult, but they remain intertranslatable, which means there is something common about the human mind and the human endeavor.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Bess Cartman.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at NASDFoundation.org.
A bachelor's degree in corruption brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, preferred lender. When you go to college, you're usually handed two things, a schedule of classes and a list of loan providers to help pay for those classes. A preferred lender is one that's on that list, but some lenders have turned it into a cheat sheet. Recently, evidence surfaced of widespread bribes and kickbacks to get on the lists. And this week, Sallie Mae, the big man on America's student loan campus, admitted they handed out perks to college aid officers.
Attention, lenders. The dean will see you now.
Got a box full of letters. Thinking
I'm Tess Vigeland, and here we are again. It's mailbag time. Chris Farrell is here. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing?
We're doing great. And Chris, of course, is our economics editor and knower of all things money related. Before we get into answering your questions, take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button, or you can give us a call with your questions. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONY. And we've got Janet on the phone from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Tess.
Well, I understand that you are a two-time winner in the Marketplace Money call-in sweepstakes. You talked to Chris about 10 years ago. What were you talking about then?
Yeah, so Chris's guest was a real estate advisor of some sort, and I called with a silly question about how I could talk my husband into building a home. But I finally did convince him, and we built a house in 2001. And I enjoyed it as much as I thought I would, and he enjoyed it so much more.
All right. Well, welcome to the program once again.
Thank you.
And what's your question for Chris this time, 10 years on?
Well, I won't tell my age, but I will tell you that my first college hours were like $3 a credit hour. And
wow.
But my real question is, my sixth of seven grandchildren has applied to both of our excellent four-year universities.
They're in Oklahoma?
In Oklahoma. He has good grades. He's a good student. He'll get in. However, our local community college has offered any Tulsa County 2007 graduate free tuition.
Wow.
How do I sell that idea to him?
So it's either, free community college or pay for a state university.
It's like turning down a $13,000 to $20,000 check.
Yeah, boy, that's a tough one. What do you think, Chris?
Just as a general statement, there is a movement, and it's a very savvy financial movement. A young person goes to community college for 2 years, and then they transfer to four-year college, and then they graduate with a diploma from that four-year college, but they paid a lot less. And so essentially, this is the strategy that you're pursuing, except for it's even more favorable because it would be free, the community college portion of this. So from a financial point of view, it's extremely savvy. As a general statement for a lot of parents that are listening to this conversation, it's a very smart thing to think about for your youngster. That's the financial side of things. There's a couple other things to consider. How important is it to your grandson and to his parents and to you that he have a four-year experience? Part of going to university for some people, and particularly if they're a public university and they're going to stay in the state, is that you meet people. Now, you don't know how that's going to evolve over a period of time, but there is a connection with people within the university, within the community, that is not as powerful if you go the financially savvy route.
Very good point.
You think you'll be able to maybe convince them that this might be at least an option?
An option, but probably a less desirable one.
Can I toss in one other idea, Tess?
Of course.
If he chooses to go to the four-year, you may want him to absorb more of that cost.
I think he's going to have lots of school loans, and his parents will expect him to pick those up.
Then I think I would encourage him, lay out the strategy, but if he's going to be owning the cost of that education and taking responsibility for it, then I would go with whichever way he wants to go.
And either way, he can root for the Sooners.
You bet.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Janet, thanks so much for the call.
Bye.
All right, let's reach into the email bag. We've got Peter writing in from La Mesa, California. And last year, he worked for a small architectural company that's now going out of business. Sorry to hear that. He's been trying to get his 1099 from them for the last 3 months, but it doesn't look like he's going to be getting the form. So he doesn't have all his pay stubs, so he's wondering what to do about their taxes because he has no actual documentation of this income. How does he deal with the IRS here?
Well, this is not an uncommon problem, so much so that the IRS even has a little form that you fill out under these circumstances. Assuming that he's not going to get it in time to fill out his taxes, there's a form that he'll want to fill out, a form 4852. I have found it easier just to go to Google or whichever search engine you use, and then you type in 1099, and actually one of your first one or two choices will be the IRS website and go right to where you need to be. Click on it, and you can just print out the forms right then and there.
Not too tough. Well, we are not the IRS, so there's no fear in asking us anything. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org. Or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. And let's go to caller number two. We've got Victoria on the line from Brentwood, New Hampshire. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, Tess. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Oh, you're most welcome. I understand you're in the fashion business.
I am. I design a line of sweaters.
A line of sweaters. Well, I suppose that's appropriate for New Hampshire, huh?
Yes, although they're not typical New Hampshire sweaters.
What do they look like?
You know, it's very hard for me to describe the kind of sweater because they vary. In the spring, sometimes they're little see-through pull-ons. In the winter, they could be turtlenecks. It's not like I do a whole line. I just do items.
And are you still working full-time?
I'm working part-time, Taff, and I'll tell you, I'm self-employed. I have no pension, no inheritance, no trust fund, and no endowment. But shortly, I'll be coming into $1.5 million.
From sweaters?
No, are you kidding? Sweaters have never paid that much money. With sweaters, I just made enough money to have a little fun and pay all the bills, and that was it.
Yeah, I was going to say, otherwise the advice would be, you know, tell your children to
go
sell
into
sweaters.
The sweater business.
Exactly. So where's the $1.5 million coming from?
Well, I had a lot of land, which I created a subdivision and sold it. And that has to do me for my old age. And so the decisions I make about how to place it are crucial.
Wow. And so Chris, certainly $1.5 million sounds like a whole lot of money, but in the grand scheme of things, unfortunately, it's not.
No, and I would imagine a lot of people are giving you advice. Why don't you buy this or why don't you buy that?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. This is the Chris Farrell program for not being taken to the cleaners.
That's exactly what I need.
And the first thing is, it may take you 3 years to decide what to do with this money. And that's perfectly fine. There is nothing wrong with that. What I would recommend is putting the money into U.S. Treasury bills. You have to worry about credit risk. You don't have to worry about the risk of inflation. Because if inflation goes up, then the interest rate on U.S. Treasury bills will go up, and as the money rolls over. So you'll stay even with inflation, which is another way of saying if it takes you 3 to 4 years to decide what to do with the money, what's worth $1.5 million today will still be worth $1.5 million 3 to 4 years from now. Because what you really want to do, you want to preserve that principal and make a little bit of interest just to protect you against inflation, and you don't want to take any credit risk while you're deciding what to do. Some of the products people are approaching you with may be the right thing. What I would do is partly what you're just doing right now, talking to people. I think it does make sense to hire a fee-only certified financial planner to do a blueprint, not to manage your money, but essentially to come up with a blueprint in what are the various trade-offs, what are the various options that you can pursue.
But Chris, as she's getting this money, can we at least give her some sort of notion of where to park it in the first place? And also, let's talk about some of the tax consequences of this, because certainly Uncle Sam is going to want his chunk of this money.
Yes, he does. Well, I mean, to park it would be in Treasury bills, because that's the most conservative option that you have. You're going to pay taxes on it. Absolutely, that's true.
So a certified financial planner with someone, I make an appointment and go and see him, get their advice on what could happen, and then can I go to two or three? I mean, I really like doing the research. I like to be involved, and I'm a hands-on person.
Absolutely. When you pick a certified financial planner, and the reason why I like that designation, it says they're educated, and what you would do is interview five or six. And you're talking about something very intimate, and it's just like with a doctor. There's going to be one of them that you're going to respond to. You got $1.5 million. It's worth that fee.
I agree.
All right. Victoria, well, thank you so much for the call, and best of luck with planning for this large amount of money that you're going to come into.
And thank you very much. I really appreciate your help.
You're most welcome. Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Well, fashion can be so fickle. It just changes with the seasons. And
I know. It's been bothering me.
Such a dilemma. But one thing that won't ever change is our desire to help you with all your financial problems. Give us a call. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right. One more reach into the email bag, Chris. We've got Drew from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And he and his wife are carrying a significant amount of credit card debt, $65,000. And it's spread across a few cards. Now, Drew says they are making the payments okay, but they don't have much left over after they make those payments. They've tried to do the old switching of balances, you know, to a new card with maybe a better interest rate, but they haven't been able to get the principal to shrink very much at all. So he's wondering what the implication of credit consolidation would be. They've looked into it a little bit. They're curious about a plan that kind of promises to pay off the loans in about 4 years. But here's the kicker. They're hoping to buy a home in 5 to 6 years. So this is a pretty sticky situation. What's your advice in terms of debt consolidation?
Okay, there's a couple things going on here. Now, the first thing is there can be these sort of debt consolidation loans. Mm-hmm. Which I'm not a big fan of. It's kind of a scam market, but there are legitimate. I mean, you can go down to your local bank and they'll also have debt consolidation loans. Yes, you're getting the convenience of writing one check, but in return for getting that extra convenience, oftentimes there's higher fees rolled into it, and actually the loans ends up being more expensive. So before you do the debt consolidation loan or loan consolidation, really check and make sure that you're going to come out ahead. What's the cost versus what you're doing already? And the next level is, do you want to go to a credit counseling service and get into one of their debt management plans?
And it sounds like, at least reading between the lines here in this email, that they're really only making minimum payments on these credit cards, in which case they're never going to get out of this hole without help.
Now, that's the lure of going to a credit counseling service, is that they're going to help you. With $65,000, I'd be incredibly wary of a plan that's going to tell you they're going to pay it off in 4 years. I'm a big fan of the consumer credit counseling services around the country, CCC. The offices vary in their quality, but if you want to check them out online, one of them to look at is the Consumer Credit Counseling Service of San Francisco. And you can do a lot of research right there. There is no magic bullet in any of these consolidation services. What there is some discipline. You're going to be managing your debt better, but it does take time. And in the end, you're going to end up having to cut back on your spending.
And in terms of being able to buy a home in 5 to 6 years, that goes on your credit report, does it not?
Well, it's not going to have that big an impact, frankly. You get rid of $65,000 worth of debt and in 4 years, 4 or 5 years, and then a mortgage lender is looking at you, and you're pretty credit worthy. If you don't pay it off, you're not going to buy, no one's going to lend you the money to buy a home anyway. So I think that's sort of a red herring. If you really want to buy a home, what we're really talking about is getting your balance sheet in good shape. And if that takes you 4 or 5 years, that's fine. If your balance sheet's in good shape, you're going to be able to buy a home. That's really the key.
All right, Drew. Well, straight from the horse's mouth, you've got Chris's advice. Best of luck to you. Unfortunately, that's all the questions we can take on this week's show. But please do leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit their contact page on our website. It's marketplace.org. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Boxers or briefs? The IRS doesn't care as long as they're clean.
This is to prevent people doing what was thought to be relatively rampant, which was giving away socks and underwear in not usable condition.
Ugh, a new law might change the way you do your spring cleaning. And we hear from a reformed tax dodger. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. It's springtime, the perfect opportunity to rid the world, or at least your house, of dust bunnies and old newspapers and shoes you haven't worn for the last 5 years. But before you take out the trash, ask yourself, could I make money on this pile of junk? Sally Herships tried.
My friend Andrea came over a couple weekends ago and vashtued my apartment. That's like a Hindu version of feng shui. We reorganized and I ended up with a huge pile of junk in the middle of my living room floor. Books, CDs, clothes, even old baseball cards. I thought about donating to charity or selling on eBay, but before I packed everything up, I wanted to know which would be better for my bank account. So I went to talk to Evelyn Kapasakis, a tax advisor at PricewaterhouseCoopers in New York.
Evelyn?
Nice to meet you.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
She said the decision really depends on your tax situation. If you're someone like me, a poor independent radio producer who itemizes their tax deductions, then it can be financially savvy to donate to charity.
If you're a freelancer or your other deductions go above this $5,000 and change limit, then you would benefit from a tax perspective by taking a deduction.
But before I donated, deducted, or itemized anything, I asked Evelyn about a strange new law I'd heard of.
What is this about socks and underwear? And
well, last summer, Congress passed a law requiring that goods that you give to charity be in good used condition. They wrote in a little provision that said that this is to prevent people doing what was thought to be relatively rampant, which was giving away socks and underwear in not usable condition.
The new law says you have to get a receipt, no matter how small your donation. Seemed like a lot of work. So I asked Evelyn what she would do if she were in my shoes, in my living room, next to my giant pile of junk.
If I can get money for it, I will get money for it, as opposed to trying to take a deduction for it, because taking a deduction for it has all those built-in hassles. So if I could thought that I could sell this whole lot of stuff, I mean, I would sell it if I thought I could.
So I decided to try. I cleared off a shelf of my old high school books and listed them for sale on Half.com. Anna Karenina, The Great Gatsby, and of course, the classic Buns of Steel Total Body Workout.
That is the sound of sleet and rainy snow hitting the air conditioner outside my window. It's really nasty out. I don't want to go outside, but I have to because I've sold this book online.
The books I listed sold, a whole bunch of them. But at prices like 75 cents each, it just didn't seem worth the repeat trips to the post office. I decided it was time to get serious. I broke out my collection of baseball cards, which I'd purchased at a 1980s-era yard sale for $4. I planned to bring them to one of those stores that sells things on eBay for you. I'd save time, make money, and stay warm.
How do you feel about baseball cards?
Baseball cards, in general, do well, but specifically rookie cards.
That's Joe Orlia. He's a co-owner of I Sold It, part of a franchise that sells your stuff on eBay for you. I asked him how it works.
The main criteria is that as long as the item sells on eBay for a minimum of $50 or more, we would gladly accept the item. The only two exceptions that we normally don't handle would be clothing or furniture. When it comes to clothing, it would have to be extremely higher-end designer and newest tags. And with furniture, it would have
that
to be...
That ruled out a lot of the stuff I want to sell. Plus, the stores take a 30% commission on the first $500. Ouch! But I didn't want to have to go back to the post office.
We've got two George Brett rookie cards.
We also have Ozzie Smith. This may be his rookie card as well. It's another Ryan card. We have Dave Winfield's card here. Another Dave Winfield. So
turns out some of my old junk may be worth something.
Did you just say the few $100 range?
Yes. I would say, on average, conservatively, about $500 to $600.
Wow, sign me up.
My George Brett rookie card only sold for $13.50. Turns out I didn't take very good care of it, but that's still a profit of 200%. If there's money out there, then I want it. If I sell my stuff, I can write a check to charity, and I don't have to worry about getting a receipt. So in this case, it does seem like one person's trash, at least the pile in my living room, is someone else's treasure. For Marketplace Money, I'm Sally Herships.
And speaking of treasure, don't bury your nest egg in the backyard. We have a better plan. Visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on Contact, or you can dial us up the old-fashioned way. Our phone number is 877-ASK-MONY. That's 877-275-6669.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
Ever since governments started taxing citizens, citizens have tried to avoid paying. They claim taxes are unconstitutional or that they shouldn't have to support wars they don't believe in. But refusing to pay taxes is more expensive than ever these days. A couple of weeks ago, the IRS boosted the fine for filing a frivolous return from $500 to $5,000. By the way, a frivolous return means failing to pay up. Producer Trey Kay spoke with a woman who had a tough time turning over her earnings to Uncle Sam.
Sharon worked as a freelance consultant in the publishing industry. Her income fluctuated wildly, so much so that from month to month, she had a hard time covering her rent and her living expenses in New York City. And she had an even harder time paying her taxes.
I thought all the money was mine. And I didn't have any interest in giving it to the IRS, nor did I think I should.
For years, she ignored her debt to Uncle Sam until the penalties ballooned. Eventually, the IRS played hardball.
They had already put a lien on my property, not that I owned anything, which means that if I bought something or if I own something, they have the right to take it.
In 2006, the IRS issued 629,813 liens on taxpayers. 3.7 million had their wages garnished. Before things got any worse, Sharon decided to face her problem.
So I went down and found out by chance that the statute of limitations on one of my tax debts amounting to $13,000 was past the collection period and was going to be written off. So, in effect, the IRS gave me a gift, you know, absolved me of a debt of $13,000.
But the gift came with strings because the IRS handed her another bill for $23,000. Sharon applied for an offer and compromise. That's when the taxpayer negotiates with the IRS on an amount that they can reasonably pay. Last year, almost 25% of these applications were accepted, including Sharon's. So she won't be paying her full tax bill. But she didn't have the same luck when she negotiated on her state taxes.
I went to the ATM machine, and lo and behold, there was this negative $6,000 balance. I went inside the bank to find out what happened, and they told me New York State had put a hold on my bank account. I was getting paid the next day, so I had automatic deposit. I was freaked out that they were going to get my paycheck. You know, I was just jumping ahead to, like, how difficult life is if you don't have access to a checking account. I mean, it was just mayhem.
Sharon went to her payroll department to stop the automatic deposit.
It was embarrassing, but as it turned out, not as embarrassing as I thought. As it turns out, that kind of information is private. And even if the payroll department knew about it, it's considered private information. So the only person who was ashamed was me. I had to deal with my feelings that this was being done to me. However, of course, this was being done to me because I had reneged. I had, you know, decided not to pay them. I am trying very hard, you know, not to make the same mistakes I've made in the past.
That means keeping close contact with her accountant and paying her taxes on time. In New York, I'm Trey Kay for Marketplace Money.
Hear that? That tick-tock, tick-tock of a clock that stalks your time, runs out, tick-tock, tick-tock. And why? It's that time of year. Take stock of earnings and lock deductions, tick-tock. The IRS knocks at 12 o'clock on Tuesday, tick-tock. Who knows? You might just walk away with a refund, tick-tock, tick-tock. And what would you do?
I'm planning to save it for IRA, retirement.
With our tax refund, we plan to put it toward the next tax bill.
We've already received it, and we're investing it in our retirement accounts.
Pretty much pay bills.
and get all my credit cards up to date.
Well, I'm going to pay my credit card bills, and also I'm going to pay the final bit of my financing for my vehicle, and possibly just put it away in my 401 and see what happens in the future. If the stock rises or falls, it all depends.
Use it to live off of, you know, rent, all that stuff.
I'm going on a trip, so trying to get through Europe on a lot of it, I guess.
I'm going to pay my property tax in my house for $2,000. And since I just found out from my car that it just broke for $2,700, I'm going to pay that too.
Tax refund? I'll put it back to the business. We're a business owner. So we'll use it as operational expense.
I'm going to send it to a village in Africa.
Yes, I plan to use my tax returns this year to go on a vacation.
I just want to pay bills. Pay bills with my tax return, definitely.
Voices from Grand Central Station in Manhattan. Wayne Ma produced the piece for us. Have an idea what you'll do with your refund? Let us know. Visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on Contact. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what is smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. Chris, it's springtime. And as any bridal magazine will tell you, it's wedding season.
This is true.
Which is why I'm assuming you wanted us to play this old Paul McCartney chestnut about long-lasting love.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine?
When I'm 64, very romantic.
Yeah, well, Paul is actually now 64, and he's in the midst of a nasty divorce.
Oh, geez. Way to ruin the mood. But, you know, his ex-wife is doing pretty well on Dancing with the Stars.
This is true. I haven't watched it, but I've read about this. But, you know, the reason why I mentioned that divorce, you know, there is a really easy way for our listeners to avoid ending up in the same boat as Mr. and the former Mrs. McCartney. Here's a straight story. Contrary to popular mythology, if you want a marriage to last till you're 64 and beyond, you should start by negotiating a prenup.
What?
Isn't that crass?
Chris? Oh, Chris, where's the romantic in you?
Now, okay.
Love is love forever and a day.
Let's take a step back. First of all, we've got to get past this belief that a prenup means you don't trust each other.
Well, doesn't it?
No. Think about a long-term commitment. Money is a big part of that relationship. You're going to own a home, probably. You have a child, and then you have earnings. Mm-hmm. When a couple gets together, they're creating a small business. And all I'm arguing for is full financial disclosure. What a prenup does is it starts a money conversation. And a money conversation in a relationship done over time is what will help hold that relationship together.
But there's a difference between talking about your finances and going into a marriage saying, hey, you know what? This doesn't work out. You get this and I get that.
Well, so.
Oh, Chris. I mean,
but no, to a large extent, what we're talking about are expectations. And so you come in with some assets and you sit down and you talk about it. And by the way, you don't do this the day before you go to the altar.
You're not going to make it to the altar then.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's hope not. You know, this is something that you start talking about long in advance. And by the way, I'm somewhat agnostic here. Now, there's the hardcore. And the hardcore believes this has to be a legal document. I don't really care. I think if you have a lot of assets, a lot of liabilities, if you're Paul McCartney, he didn't have a prenup. Where were his advisors? I have no idea. He should have.
Whoops.
In those situations, you need lawyers. And by the way, both parties get represented. But in a lot of cases, you may not need a lawyer. Mm-hmm. But what you really do need is let's end up with a written document. Doesn't matter whether it's legally enforceable. And so you really start working things through. If you don't have that conversation, you're going to have it after you're married when there's a lot of pressure. So why not start it early?
So you're really saying that this just forces the conversation and you're not necessarily sitting down and saying, okay, you know what? We may get divorced sometime. So
absolutely not. Absolutely. My hope is that 45, 50, 60 years from when you got together, there's this yellow document that you find in the attic and you go, oh, hey, that was our prenup. No. This is not about getting divorced. This is about maintaining the relationship.
All right. For those who have already done the deed and gotten the old ball and chain, that being both the husband or the wife.
Thank you.
what is the function then, perhaps, of a post-nup? It's never too late to talk about this stuff, is it?
It's never too late to talk about this stuff. Now, the post-nup, I'm a little more skeptical about. It is increasingly popular. There's more discussion about it. My feeling is, at that point, what we're really talking about is marriage counseling. What a post-nup essentially is doing is saying, you know what, if this marriage counseling doesn't work out, here's how we're going to divide the assets, and we're going to decide it now before we've actually decided to get divorced. So I'm not a big post-nup fan. I'm a big prenup fan. Now, full disclosure, the reason why I like to say prenup, it's a way of getting attention. I got your attention.
You certainly did.
And it's a way of starting the conversation.
All right. The straight story from our resident romantic, Chris Farrell. I'm sure it's excellent advice. I just don't want to think about it.
But maybe in the back of your mind, a seed has been planted.
Perhaps. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, recycling gets a raise.
They're Americans. Give them money. Pay them. You know, it's certainly legal, and it's good old-fashioned American capitalism, but with a twist of helping the environment.
We're trying to put a twist on your personal finances. Tell us what you think of the show. Head on over to our website at marketplace.org. You can also check out our special features like podcasts and video clips. Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes with Rico Galliano, Nancy Fargali, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yorp. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
American Public Media.